Wintrust Business Lunch with Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Jason, I hope you're doing well today.
Doing well. I hope you are as well, John.
And I think we are all doing fine. So somebody put it to me this way. We had a very small gain in jobs in this latest report, but sometimes you actually have negative job growth, and we don't have that. So I guess the question is, how bad is this August report, Jason?
And the August report, the ADP report that came out this morning, looking at private payrolls, yes, is the lowest increase we've seen since the beginning of 2021. However, it's still an increase. Something to keep in mind that we're not seeing, and we go back to the JOLTS data that came out earlier this week on job openings, and the hiring rate there actually ticked up slightly, even though job openings declined. So a little bit of conflicting information over the last 2 days as it relates to employment reports. I would underscore this one is the job market, the employment markets are gradually cooling. There's no doubt that there's cooling there, but this doesn't seem to be a panic-inducing report that the bottom has fallen out of the employment markets and the Fed is going to have to act more significantly later this month.
Yeah, so what do you think the Fed is going to do through the end of the year?
I think the first move in September here starts the cutting cycle, but they most likely cut 25 basis points. It's somewhat symbolic. Everybody knows they're going to cut as we march forward. The employment report tomorrow, the unemployment report tomorrow morning, will largely influence how significant some Fed participants think the slowdown in employment markets are. But from what I'm seeing, the data is consistent with a normalizing employment market as opposed to a collapsing one. Mm-hmm. And that underscores the Fed cutting 25 basis points in September. What they do in November and December would still be open questions.
Well, but in general, a shrinking job market influences the Fed's decisions how?
Well, the Fed operates with a dual mandate, stable prices and full employment, and they've been very, very focused on the stable prices end of the spectrum, as they should, with inflation peaking over 9% a couple of years ago, and still elevated above their target today. But they've rightfully pivoted their focus to the other side of the dual mandate and the idea of full employment, and we've watched that unemployment rate jump up from the mid-3s to now into the low to mid-4s, creating some concern for folks in the economy that employment markets are now feeling the impact of those higher rates that the Fed set in place over the last couple of years. The mission then for the Fed would be to lower those rates to relieve the stress on employment markets.
Can you contrast for us inflation with wages?
Of course. We've seen inflation, particularly core inflation that the Fed watches very closely, moving slowly towards the 2% target. I would largely say that inflation, just price change data, is on track to eventually reach the Fed's 2% target without any sort of additional policy needed to push it there. Wage growth has been running a little hotter than what would be consistent with the 2% target. But if I look at the various different wage growth metrics, and let's call wage growth about 4% here, a wage growth number of 3.5% would be consistent with the Fed's 2% target. So we're almost there from a wage growth perspective. It was also good to see a positive revision to productivity numbers, meaning that for every unit of labor, we're getting a little bit more production out of the economy, meaning employers aren't having to pay up for individuals to take those roles like they did a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. That's helping to create less pressure on inflation as well. So broadly speaking, a cooling economy, but not one that is seeing extreme pressures on prices or on employment markets.
One last question, Jason. Is there a sweet spot, a target, if you will, for the difference between inflation and inflation and wages? Is it 2%, 3%, 1.5%? What's ideal there? Do you know?
The ideal target for wages and inflation includes productivity. So generally speaking, wage growth should mirror what the increase in prices and the increase in productivity are on an annual basis. That's where we come up with that 3.5%, that on average, productivity has been up over the last couple of decades about 1.5%. and inflation's averaged or is targeted to average around that 2% target. So 3.5% wage growth is consistent. As we see stronger productivity numbers, you could support slightly higher wage growth because generally employers are willing to share some of the additional success of the business in producing more things with their employees.
Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management, wintrustwealth.com. Nice summary there of where we are today. Jason, thanks for your help.
Thanks. Nice to be with you, John.
Bree Fowler joins us again, senior writer at CNET. Hi, Bree.
Hey, great to be with you.
What should we start with? I'm kind of intrigued by X getting X'd out of Brazil. What's happened there?
Yeah, it's kind of wild, actually. A judge ruled there that they will be blocked. He's worried about, regulatory issues, things like that. There are orders. It needs to pay fines, which at this point are totaling about $3 million. And people actually could be fined, too, if they use a VPN to get onto X. Elon Musk is not happy about this, as you might imagine.
Wasn't there an issue about him not appointing an attorney to represent him in the case, something like that?
Yeah, they're supposed to have someone in the country that represents the country and that represents the company, and he has failed to comply with that. And that's one of those things where the judge is not budging on this. And actually, a panel of other judges on Monday ruled to back this judge in his ruling.
Right. A five-panel Supreme Court there backed the judge. It sounds petty, which is Elon Musk is very capable of, and $3 million isn't going to get his attention. Is X then deplatformed in Brazil? People in Brazil can't get on Twitter. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, supposedly it is blocked. That it is, you can't get on there unless you mask your location. If you use a VPN, which would hide where you are, you could log in. And, what's really been interesting about this is it's shown how many Twitter/X accounts are actually based in Brazil. A lot of celebrity fan accounts, things like that. Brazil is very, very into things like Comic-Con and stuff like that. And there were all these, sad goodbye posts on X over the weekend, as people shut down their accounts.
What's the Russian disinformation story? We looked up at our screens and all the networks were covering it yesterday. What happened?
Yeah, the Biden administration is taking action against Russian-run websites, and it's actually filed charges against two state media employees, and they're alleging disinformation operations. This is nothing new. Russia has done this before, especially leading up to elections and especially dealing with Ukraine, getting those viral stories out there on social media that unwitting Americans will actually amplify and share to their own accounts. And people will think that they're true. And it's all to further Russian intelligence agendas.
I don't know which came first, the cart or the horse in this Tennessee-based company that got $10 million from Russia to create videos that favored Russia, say, in the case of the war against Ukraine. Was the company doing that and Russia just decided to fuel them with money? Or did Russia hire them to make these videos and promote the Russian cause?
I think it's more of the latter, but that's definitely something where it's going to have to come out in court and, and more investigation is going to need to be done. And you're right, like chicken and egg kind of thing. Who knows exactly? Companies are more than happy to take money for, doing social media work. Whether they look the other way, whether they know, that's anyone's guess.
Well, you would think that if you've got $10 million in your bank account, you ought to know how it got there. I know that one of these video creators is claiming innocence, and I'm not sure I buy that. Verizon Frontier, what's on the frontier here?
Yeah, this is Verizon expanding their fiber footprint. They are buying Frontier Communications for $20 million. This is a lot of money. It's a big deal. Basically, they're shoring up their infrastructure as we get more into artificial intelligence and connected smart devices. you know, Frontier has concentrated heavily on a fiber network over the past 4 years. It's invested $4.1 billion into expanding its own network. And they get a ton of their revenue from fiber products. So this is, you know, an investment for Verizon in infrastructure and just kind of future-proofing it for down the road.
Hmm. Fiber cables, that's what we're talking about, right? Like they're laying it underground across cities and states across America, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, you think about Fios, you know, the cables that come into your home, that's fiber. And, you know, right now Verizon has about 7.4 million Fios connections in nine states in D.C., and they're going to add 7.2 million fiber locations of Frontier's, and this dramatically expands their footprint.
Does it make a difference? I'm trying to think of a. I don't have one of these major companies at my house. I believe I'm getting my internet through Twine. It's very slow and it's not really good. Is fiber like appreciably better than however else we get our internet?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is, you know, the connective systems for, you know, fast home internet, for small, medium businesses, things like that. I mean, you also could get it from a cable company, those kinds of things. I mean, these are expensive services for consumers and businesses, but more and more, you know, it's becoming the way of the world.
Hey, are the people with Dish TV getting the ESPN and Apple services or the Disney services?
You know, I have not checked into that, actually. I know that there was a dispute and they were trying to get that settled, especially before football starts this weekend. But yeah. I'm not sure what the status of that is.
Yeah, nor am I. I'll probably hear from some listeners now because I know during the U.S. Open, all of a sudden it went away and people were like, what's going on here? But these two juggernauts have sort of come to a head and they just threw the switch and said, okay, until we get a deal that we think is best for us, we're not going to carry your products. And there we were as of about a day ago.
Wow. I mean, my husband and I, we're big college football people. And, you know, if we can't watch game day on Saturday morning, there's an issue.
Well, don't you think there's going to come a point where a lot of the sports are really what are keeping terrestrial TV in many ways still competitive, right?
Right. I mean, I know that's true for my house. That's the one thing that keeps us on, you know, Fios or cable, things like that. We need our live sports. And right now, you really can't. I mean, you can kind of piecemeal it together with the different networks and services through streaming. But gosh, cable and you know, Fios types of services make it a heck of a lot easier.
A friend of ours here at the radio station who comes on and helps people with their tech stuff made a list of all of the different platforms that you can subscribe to, A, to watch sports, but B, just to consume anything like all of the Hulu channels and Prime and Disney and so forth. Anyway, there's 93 services out there, and it's just too much. It's just too much of a good thing right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, when we moved, that was one of the things that I did when we were looking at our family budget, was to kind of audit those streaming services. You know, which ones are we using? Which ones are the kids using? And, you know, as a consumer, a lot of these come free or included with things like, you know, your wireless phone service, or, you know, different types of things like that, or even, you know, maybe your cable. Yeah. There are definitely ways that you can, you know, cut your costs, but, you know, it's kind of getting ridiculous at this point.
I'm with you. Bree Fowler over at CNET.com. Okay, Bree, we'll talk again. Thanks for your help today.
Yeah, have a good one.
Let's talk to Dale Buss next, the contributing editor of Chief Executive Magazine and the founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition. Dale actually writes for other publications, too. You'll see some of his stories in food technology. And I think that's where we catch up with you today. Hi, Dale. How are you?
Great. Yeah, John, absolutely. I want to talk to you about the food business, which I know is of such great importance to your listeners. And what's interesting is I've been working on a story for food technology for the next issue about the use of artificial intelligence in food development. And, you know, certainly with all the excitement over generative AI, ChatGPT over the last year or so, Every area of industry, right, is excited about this. I mean, NVIDIA is now the world's most valuable company, I think, because of its involvement with AI. But one of the interesting areas of business application of both generative AI, which deals with a lot of external data, right, everything online, and internal data that companies generate is food product development.
Food product development. Dale, hold on one second. We're going to reconnect with you just because I want to hear what you have to say, and it's only a little fuzzy right now. But let's talk about food development. AI is everywhere. In fact, I'll just read part of his story. Like most food scientists, Rachel Zemser is a tyro with artificial intelligence. But when the Almond Board of California asked her to play around with TasteWise IO, and use the AI platform to come up with some product ideas around gut health and dietary needs of Generation Z, she dove in. AI, working on our gut health and food options. Okay, let's pick it up here, Dale. You still there?
Yeah. This is an example of how the food business, you know, which has been kind of a laggard in terms of applying new technologies over the years, actually, in terms of AI, is doing a great job of leveraging the capabilities of AI to come up with new flavors, new ingredients, new experiments in products at an incredibly faster rate than human food developers have been able to do it. Now, ultimately, the humans have to test everything, but AI can help them come up with hundreds, thousands of ideas much quicker than they could on their own, and kind of play around with them and test them and see if they have any chance of working. And food is actually the area of a business where there's probably more information online about food than practically any other topic. If you think about recipes, food blogs, restaurant menus, home delivery menus, I mean, social media people talk about food all the time, right? Food porn. Photos.
Well, I hope that the AI is being used in a way that not just makes it more addictive or tasty, but, you know, healthier for us.
Yeah, it's very productive for food companies, you know, which there are so many in the Chicago area. They can fire up their AI engines using their internal data that they've been gathering over the years, and also generative AI, which combs the internet for all this external data. And it can present them with ideas that they wouldn't have come up with themselves or that would have taken years or months to develop. Big food companies like Kraft Heinz, for example, which is big in Chicago, has worked with a company that has an AI engine to come up with its non-dairy line of products that imitate iconic Kraft brands like mac and cheese, Oscar Mayer hot dogs. And that wouldn't have been possible without the use of an AI engine, or at least it would have taken several more years. And this is example after example of how the food industry is harnessing AI to just make its process faster and less expensive. And ultimately, the hope is more effective.
Let's just mention a couple of companies and tell me what they're doing. Coca-Cola.
Yeah, Coca-Cola and PepsiCo both are heavily involved in using AI. And actually, AI late last year, they came up with a limited edition product that they called Y3000 Zero Sugar, trying to indicate this is something that's so far-fetched that it's from the year 3000, right? But it had kind of a weird tutti-frutti character to the flavor. And they marketed it, and they even used AI to come up with a new version of their Christmas polar bear. And just to kind of show as a demonstration project, I guess, of what AI makes possible.
Yeah.
PepsiCo came up with a whole new product line of actually seaweed snacks that it calls Off the Eaten Path, in less than 12 months using insights from AI that showed consumers, you know, would be interested in that kind of a product. And boom, it was out there.
I suppose that may help the company either discover flavor combinations that would have taken a lot more time and more traditional testing, or like you said, just cull from data that's out there. But I wonder if consumers want AI to be involved in the creation of their food. Would you put your stamp on that, the new AI Coca-Cola, for instance, or would you not advertise that?
Yeah, that's interesting because there's some research to suggest that consumers are willing to try lots of new things. But if you say this is developed with AI, that's a negative for them, at least, you know, at this point. So it's kind of like almost saying like, well, you'd love this product, but it's got GMOs or something. So
right.
At this point, the AI origin is not a virtue or a plus for the foods that are coming out using it. But yeah, you know, that may change, obviously.
Yeah, but not a selling point right now. And I suspect you're right about that. Unilever, you wrote, has harnessed AI to launch new products, including Hellmann's vegan mayonnaise. Ocean Spray is using AI to plumb all the possible healthful effects of cranberries, including ones that may be influenced by various locations where they're grown. Wow, that's a deep dive, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if cranberries are grown in Wisconsin, which is a huge cranberry state, or if they're grown in Massachusetts, for instance, they may have slightly different what are known as phytonutrients in the molecules, which may kind of influence, you know, in subtle ways at least, how healthful that particular cranberry crop or strain of cranberry is. And, you know, health is really important to Ocean Spray because that's, you know, the whole proposition behind cranberries is how good they are for you. So it's AI is allowing Ocean Spray, working with a company called Brightseed, to get even deeper into differentiating the health properties of its crops.
Mm. Dale Buss writing for Food Technology, which is published in Chicago by the Institute of Food Technologists. You also read his stuff at the Flyover Coalition. I direct you to flyovercoalition.org all the time. Dale, good to talk to you today. Fascinating stuff there,
right,
my friend.
Thanks, John.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch, more business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report shows Illinois, California, and New Jersey have the highest concentrations of at-risk housing markets in the country. The report was compiled by Adam, a curator of land, property, and real estate data. The Special Housing Risk Report spotlights county-level housing markets vulnerable to declines based on home affordability, underwater mortgages, and other measures. It found some of the biggest clusters were around Chicago, New York City, and inland California. The locations around Chicago include parts of Cook, Kendall, McHenry, and Will counties. Lake County, Indiana was also highlighted. Counties are considered at risk based on the percentages of homes facing possible foreclosure, the portion of mortgage balances that exceeded estimated property values, the percentage of average local wages required to pay for home ownership expenses, and local unemployment rates. There's a new ranking of the country's top 100 colleges and universities with startup founders. PitchBook ranks schools based on the number of alumni entrepreneurs who found success in the venture capital market during the last decade. Northwestern was the top-ranked Chicago-area university on the list at number 18. 605 founders there raised nearly $22 billion. The University of Chicago was ranked 67. 274 founders there raised $15 billion. The top Illinois school was the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, which ranked 10th. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, thank you, sir. Now we've got the business of food. We've got Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and it's corn maze time again.
I love it.
A bunch of them are opening this weekend, including George Richardson's John Deere Maze. How are you doing, George?
Good. Well, give me a second to shut my tractor off.
Okay, while you do that, I will thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, George, your annual corn maze sounds like a doozy this year, an homage to John Deere.
Yeah, one of the most intricate designs we've had. 10.8 miles of trails this year featuring John Deere, a loader over on one side, got a pumpkin in the bucket. Then over on the other side of the maze is a giant quadra-track monster tractor, and we got all these funny little angles with this particular design. Very few dead ends, so you can't get lost.
And there's a kid section. No getting lost there.
One's a left turns only, one's a right turns only.
The John Deere Maze at Richardson's Adventure Farm will open for the season this Saturday at 10 a.m., and then after that,
Thursdays through Sundays, and we'll run through October 27th. This year.
George and his brother got out of the pig business and into agritourism and the corn maze business in 2001.
We found out from selling cut-your-own Christmas trees which we still do, that we really like talking with people a whole lot more than we like talking with pigs.
He says you can make a day out of it or an evening.
All the grounds are gently lighted. All the activities are running, campfires all over the place. It cools down. It's beautiful.
And lots to do besides the corn maze, including a zip line.
Off the 30-foot deck. And it goes down about 700 feet to a nice landing.
And pig races.
Every 2 hours, they're phenomenal.
And there's food trucks and a lot more.
And RichardsonFarm.com, our website, all the information they want. They can buy tickets in advance if they want to.
And how do we get there from Chicago, George?
Spring Grove is northwest of Chicago, close to the state line, just 14 miles off I-94.
Saturday, opening day for what George calls the world's largest corn maze. From the dairy farm to your belly.
Pizza.
It's National Cheese Pizza Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Mike Lavatola joins us from Foxtrot Cafe and Market, the chairman there. Good news we're hearing about your business. Mike, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to reopen starting with the Gold Coast, right?
Absolutely. Doors were open at 6 a.m. this morning.
I heard that you're doing free coffee again. Was there a line for that?
There was this morning, yeah. So it was great to see so many folks back and get the coffee brewers fired up again.
For those who don't know about Foxtrot, describe the marketplace for you guys. What kind of food delivery are you?
Yeah, so, best way to think about us is like a modern-day convenience store. So we go out and find the best craft beer, wines, ice cream, cookies, candy, kind of all the fun stuff, and bring it all into one place with a, really high focus on local and small makers. And then we've got a cafe side, too. So, locally roasted coffee, in the morning with their breakfast tacos, and then a nice sandwich and salad spread for lunch.
How many total stores do you anticipate opening in the next 6 months or year?
Yeah, we will open about 10 of the former locations back up.
So it'll be all of the locations that had previously closed will be opened up again?
Not all of them, but about 10. So we had, 15 in Chicago prior to the closure earlier this year, and in Chicago we'll have about 8 open back up, and then two in Texas as well.
The closing caught a lot of people off guard. What has changed? How are you all able to open again, and what will be different this time so that doesn't happen?
Yeah, so it's under both new and old leadership, right? So we were able to bring back many of the folks who were part of the team originally and were able to grow it during its early years. And then I think importantly there's a big refocusing on what made the brand really successful in its early days, which was really tight partnership and high curation of these local brands. So finding the best stuff around Chicago and putting it into one place and really doubling down there.
As a convenience store, I think we all know that you pay for convenience, and then your stuff's tended to be, like you said, locally curated, but sometimes not the least expensive on the market. Are you confident the economy will support you all the second time around?
Yeah, absolutely. And, we have items across all price points, right? I mean, sometimes it's a Tuesday and you want a cheap six pack to kind of get the job done. And sometimes it's a Friday night and you want a beautiful bottle of wine. So we, really focus on finding the best across all price points and trying to have a little something for everyone, no matter what your budget is.
What are some of the items that you are excited about? When people come into your store, what are they going to see? What are you ready and happy to sell them?
Well, I am very excited that our breakfast tacos are back. So they were our top-selling item. They were certainly my favorite item. And we really spent the summer rebuilding those from the ground up. So you'll see new flavors, but kind of more importantly, up-leveled ingredients across our tacos. And then, of course, our gummies, which people love a lot, are back as well.
You said, what was that people are excited about?
Gummy candies. Like gummy bears and stuff like that, yeah.
Not the kind laced with marijuana, though, right?
Until the laws change, we don't have those.
That would be an interesting combination. I wonder if you can sell alcohol, and to a lot of us, marijuana is on the same page now. I wonder when that day will come. Will you be able to retail that?
Yeah, well, you know, there actually are some local beverage makers like Mars Brewing, as an example, who have THC in some of their beverage products, and also Hopewell here in the city, and we're actually happy to feature those. So some of our beverages do include those items.
The location nearest and dearest to me is the one over by Tribune Tower. There was one in Tribune Tower, right?
Yes, there was.
And what's the game plan for that one?
Tribune Tower is unfortunately not coming back, but we have one not too far away in River North and in Gold Coast, and hopefully Streeterville as well.
Good luck to you guys, Mike. I know that when you guys closed, people were really sad to see it. There's a lot of positive buzz about it reopening and starting today at the one location anyway, right?
Absolutely, yes. And then Old Town opens up a couple weeks from now, and then we'll go from there.
Good luck, Mike. Thanks for your time today.
Okay, thanks.